50 years ago, the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a force against oppression and discrimination. One of the premier architects for the Declaration was Eleanor Roosevelt.
If the women are willing to do things because it's going to help their neighbors, I think we'll win out. We'll win out not because of a government, not even because of our leaders, but because as a people we've had a vision and we've worked for it and we've seen it through.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
This is Lise Anzieff. We're going to be talking today with five women who are vital contributors to the United Nations. Their work includes helping the children and women of the world who are suffering today from poverty, from human trafficking, from the horrible crimes of war and conflict, from inequality and gender-based discriminations, helping countless others achieve a greater stand in their community and their world.
If the women are willing to do things because it's going to help their neighbors, I think we'll win out.
That was the voice of Eleanor Roosevelt. In the wake of a devastating world war which had witnessed some of the most barbarous crimes in human history, Eleanor Roosevelt was the chairperson for the early United Nations Human Rights Commission. In 1953, after the election of Dwight D. Eisenhower and rising conservatism coming out of the White House, Eleanor resigned her post as U.S. delegate for the United Nations. At that time, she joined forces with the UN in a different way, with the American Association for the United Nations. She then became the official American representative to the World Federation of the United Nations Associations. In 1961, she was reappointed as a U.S. delegate to the United Nations by a more liberal President Kennedy. This appointment was to last only 2 years. In 1963, Eleanor Roosevelt died from tuberculosis.
Eleanor Roosevelt was not alone in her accomplishments or her international interests. There were other women who had long been doing this kind of work.
Historian Margaret Pitcher was born in New York City to parents who met in their youth at the International House of Columbia University. She grew up in the international milieu of New York City's intelligentsia in the 1940s, when the Second World War was raging and the United Nations was being formed. Her family was personally involved in the tragedies of the war and the worldwide efforts for reconstruction and attempts to build a lasting peace. At that time, Margaret's father took part in efforts to promote the recognition of human rights as she observed the first meetings of the United Nations at Lake Success, New York. She is currently traveling on a writer's expedition in the Gobi Desert of Mongolia.
In public relations, you choose one person to be the forefront of things that are going on. And in 1945, Franklin Roosevelt appointed Virginia Gildersleeve, delegate to the United Nations Charter Committee. She was very internationally minded. There were a lot of women who were doing a lot of things in the background, and leading women, not just in the United States, but in other countries. Eleanor Roosevelt was only one of them.
Hello?
Denise?
Hi.
Oh, this sounds good. Okay. Denise Scotto's legal skills and management background served the United Nations Division for the Advancement of Women, where her responsibilities included action as a liaison with UN Secretariat departments, UN specialized agencies, governments, and civil society, as well as organizing panels and special events. With her special interest in international human rights and women's rights, Ms. Scotto is the current vice chair of the NGO Committee on the Status of Women in New York. She represents the International Federation of Women Lawyers, also at the United Nations. Could you tell us how CSW is reporting for women, working with women, and trying to advance women in the UN?
Well, the Commission on the Status of Women just celebrated its 50th anniversary. And in that time, the UN Commission on the Status of Women, I think, has been able to really move forward in the legal landscape a lot of standards which set forth human rights obligations that deal with women, adolescents, girls. And I can give you some examples of those. We have the CEDAW, the Convention to Eliminate All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, and its optional protocol. We have had the ad hoc criminal tribunals of the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, and we've had the seminal case law that held that rape is a war crime with the Akayesu case, that genocide is a war crime with the Karanik case. We have torture as a war crime, torture of women. We have the International Criminal Court, which has been established. And again, those standards have been set, which really is groundbreaking because, again, it's codified in international law that war crimes and crimes against humanity do include rape as a war crime, forced pregnancy, sexual slavery, prostitution. We also have the Palermo Convention and the optional protocol that deals with trafficking in persons, which is very significant. And we have Security Council Resolution 1325 that deals with women and armed conflict. So I think that the Commission on the Status of Women has had a huge impact sowing the seeds for a lot of these advances to have occurred.
These are tremendous, tremendous.
Yeah, it really has been tremendous. Not to say that there's not a lot that still needs to be done. The UN reform that we've had this year, including the establishment of a peace-building commission, is very significant. There needs to be a commitment to including women.
I want to just start by saying I think there's lots of areas of progress still going on for women.
Charlotte Bunch is world-renowned for her leadership in gaining international recognition that the rights of women and girls are inseparable from universal human rights. Her vision was key to bringing together women activists at the 1993 UN World Conference on Human Rights in Vienna, where, for the first time, 171 states agreed to end violence against women worldwide. She is founder of the Center for Women's Global Leadership, distinguished professor in women's and gender studies at Rutgers, and the recipient of many awards, including the 2002 Women Who Make a Difference Award by the International Women's Forum.
Progress for women is always some steps forward, some steps backward, and various things are happening at different levels and sectors and in different regions at different times. In some regions, particularly in Latin America, there's been a really significant increase in the number of women successful in politics and moving into cabinets and ministries and defense ministers, and Michelle Bachelet became the president of Chile. In terms of the overall UN picture, I think we're seeing some backward moves for women. I think they are a direct result of the rise of more conservative, more fundamentalist governments around the world, starting with the United States. The power of the United States to move the agenda within the UN on women backward can never be underestimated. There are some parts of that that people know well, like the taking away the funding of the UN Fund for Population in the name of so-called abortion issues, which the fund is not really even about, and some of the more specific ways that we've seen the Bush administration try to renege on the promises of the Beijing Platform for Action, making many of us who've been working in the international arena spend a lot of time defending things that we felt had already progressed. So we haven't really lost any of the commitments in CEDAW or Beijing. They haven't been defeated. They're still on the books. But what we do see is a stalling. led by the United States, but also supported by many other conservative and fundamentalist countries around the world. And people in the U.S. really don't realize how often the Bush administration votes with countries like Iran on issues related to women.
With representatives from 189 nations, the Fourth World Conference on Women in the Republic of China's capital city of Beijing in 1995 grabbed the attention of the worldwide press.
It was a landmark conference in the sense that it addressed nearly all issues that confront women.
Mavic Cabrera Baeza is a senior program associate for the International Women's Tribune Center, producing radio programs and other media material.
The Beijing Platform for Action, which was the output document of the Fourth World Conference on Women. There were what were called 12 critical areas of concerns that included poverty, armed conflict, women's health and reproductive rights, women in agriculture, education, media. It was referred to as Conference of Commitment.
Agreements that they're making now, we're struggling to hold on to commitments that were made in the past. And so when we look at the Beijing Declaration from the early 90s, it's becoming harder and harder for governments to even agree that they agreed in the first place.
Hailing from Cape Town, South Africa, Samantha Cook explored a number of different career possibilities before deciding to become a lawyer. In July 2005, she accepted a full-time position at Peace Women Project at the UN Office of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom in New York. Today, Peace Woman is working globally with numerous organizations to implement international humanitarian and human rights laws that protect the rights of women and girls during and after conflicts. This includes safety from mines, rape, and aggression.
Women continue to struggle with violence. They continue to struggle with poverty. And although governments are making commitments in the Millennium Development Goals, etc., etc., they're not being implemented.
Women's NGOs globally have been working on the Millennium Development Goals since the Millennium Project began in 2002. 191 nations agreed by consensus by the year 2015 that all nations will have programs installed and solutions in place to remove extreme poverty and hunger, to achieve universal primary education, to promote gender equality and empower women, to reduce child mortality and improve maternal health, to combat HIV, AIDS, malaria, and other diseases, to ensure environmental sustainability and develop a global partnership between all nations.
You know, it's so wonderful, all these promises that were made. Do you feel that the problem in the implementation is political, just the political matrix, more than actually getting the programs to happen?
Well, I think it happens on a number of levels. I think when you're with governments negotiating with one another in the UN system and intergovernmental agreements, there's certainly a lot of political play. And unfortunately, programs and projects and even commitments to women's equality become pawns in this political game. You know, we'll give you this here if you don't make us do that over there. And women's rights issues are not prioritized enough, so they become the things that get thrown away. And then on another level, while governments are willing to commit to things in words, it comes down to spending money. And we know that governments don't like to spend money on things that they don't think are important enough. And so while they'll spend a lot of money on the military machine, it's a little harder for them to spend money on a health clinic for women or to spend money on a program that will educate women so that they can participate effectively in elections. They're just not prioritizing these things. Part of that is also because there's so many men in government, and so they don't feel touched by the issue in the same way, which is unfortunate. And the UN itself has that problem. I mean, it's operationally, the UN isn't committing enough resources to the gender equality agenda. The one thing that the Secretary General has in the past pointed to is that member states need to nominate women for positions, and they need to put forward the names of women. And we know there are plenty of very capable women. Often, you know, some of us think more capable and competent often than some of the men. But you know, I heard a story recently. I think it was in relation to Sweden, on the national level where there was a woman who was in a position where she could appoint. And when she received nominations that didn't have sufficient women on the list, she would send it back and say, I'm not accepting the list until you've got more women candidates on it. And so there's some level of responsibility there from the UN system. And then once women get into the system, others say, well, you know, we appoint women and then they leave. And I'm sure we've all heard that in our workplaces. It's not just in the UN. I don't know, people who work in law firms I'm sure have heard, yes, we'd love women partners, but they just have babies and then they leave. Well, if the working environment in all of these places were more conducive to being able to take on responsibilities of family, and if men shared responsibilities of family, if the actual environment made it a good place for women to be, perhaps some of these women would in fact stay. So I think, you know, the culpability for all of this is on many levels. And then we simply also sit with our hierarchical gender norms and society's attitudes. And it's sort of an unthinking thing of just accepting that there are just so many men in these decision-making positions. When you see UN country teams, UNIFEM isn't always at the table. You don't always have the women-specific agencies even represented in the UN country teams. And so when the UN is implementing projects, and they do very good work, they don't always have that gender perspective, and they don't always concentrate on the programs that would be beneficial to women.
When you mention UNIFEM and the, you know, how UNIFEM isn't always at the table, what do you think needs to happen to bring the women's agencies to the table?
Well, I think that it has to happen on different levels. There's a lot of talk at the moment about upgrading the women's machinery or the gender equality architecture. These are terms that get thrown around on an operational level, but it means a number of different things. The one is that an agency like UNIFEM, be it UNIFEM or something else, must have a strong mandate and be independent enough to be able to implement that mandate. And then it needs the resources, and it needs the staff, and it needs staff who are well trained, and it needs staff who don't simply have gender mainstreaming as a tag on to the rest of their job, because that also isn't something that the individual concerned can cope with. I mean, if somebody has, you know, a huge job description, and then they get told, oh, and by the way, you're responsible for gender mainstreaming, it's a little difficult. Mm-hmm. So there need to be structural changes to make it such that there's a strong mandate at the operational level to deal with women's issues. And then there need to be the resources. And I think that's the question we come back to again and again, is getting more resources and dedicated resources.
Originally from the Philippines, Mavic Cabrera-Baeza is a senior program associate for the International Women's Tribune Center, where she is in charge of producing media materials to highlight women and peace. Mavic is also board member of the Asian Communication Network and a member of the oversight panel for the UN Development Program's Information Disclosure Policy. Last March, Mavic coordinated a panel discussion called UN Reform and Its Relevance to Women. She currently edits a publication on the same topic and is active in her work to ensure a place for women's human rights and equality within the UN process.
Yeah, the changes that we see in this UN reform process should consider women's human rights and gender equality as key principles.
I know that you and all of the agencies involved with women have been pushing so hard, trying to get women sitting at the table with the decision-making powers.
Oh, exactly. We're not buying, you know, the reason of no money, no funding to get the women here. We'll get the money, we'll find the money, we'll pass the hat, and we'll make sure that we are represented and we are active participants in this discussion on reforming the UN, because the changes that we see in this UN reform process will impact heavily on women. Even this discredited Commission on Human Rights was able to put in place a reporting mechanism that looked at issues of violence against women, issues of trafficking of women. There were some elements that we you know, that we wanted to salvage from that old commission into this new Human Rights Council. And it looks like the lobbying, that active lobbying that women's organizations did, made a difference. So they've retained the reporting mechanisms, and they've retained the system of having special rapporteurs on violence against women, on trafficking, on different issues that matter to women in terms of women's human rights.
The special rapporteurs, I think, are doing incredible work because they get no salary from the UN. They do this on a voluntary basis.
United Nations Special Rapporteurs on Violence Against Women are special investigators and examiners who have been mandated by the UN to monitor the extreme violations of human rights that are happening now against women in many countries around the world. This occurs in situations of conflict as well as peace. To complete their investigations, the special rapporteurs observe and prepare studies, creating sets of compliance guidelines and actions for the UN General Assembly. All of this is done in hopes that their observations and feedback will offer help and improvement in key areas of human rights violations, women and gender rights violations, and the hopefully ensuing humanitarian outreach.
Denise Scotto, it seems as though there's been some controversy about the special rapporteurs and their efficiency, how they are communicating and how much attention they're being given by the General Assembly. Could you go into that for me?
Well, I think that the special rapporteurs have achieved a lot. They're, quote, independent experts, and a lot of them have been incredible international law professors. A lot of them have been preeminent in their field. The special rapporteurs are investigating allegations of grave human rights abuses. So, from that standpoint, member states, especially those who are criticized by a special rapporteur who's gone to a country to conduct a fact-finding mission, which writes a report that's very negative about the country, you know, of course member states are not going to be embracing the special rapporteurs and would not want to contribute more and more funding for them to proceed in their work. For the most part, most of the times, their trips to a country is paid for by the country, by the member state where they're investigating. But that hasn't always been the case. The special rapporteur has a very small office in Geneva and basically one staff person who helps in terms of administration of setting up meetings and helping to write reports. I think that the special rapporteurs, or the special procedures as they're considered in the UN, do need to have more funding allocated in terms of their mandate.
That's a good point.
The first special rapporteur on violence against women, Radhika Kumaraswamy, if you read any of her reports, they are just really incredible in terms of moving forward the legal landscape and standard settings. And, you know, Gay McDougall is another one who's moved forward the agenda. You know, we have now the special rapporteur on violence against women, Yakina Turk, who is again doing so much with the legal basis to move things forward. We have Vernon Munoz that deals with the right to education, that has been moving forward a lot to deal with education of girls and women. We have Mulan Kothari in terms of housing and habitat. You know, so I think that the mandate of a lot of the special rapporteurs are not exclusively regarding women, but I think that they've incorporated into their mandate and into their vision a way to move the agenda forward that does include women and girls.
There used to be a woman head of the peacekeeping mission in Burundi, Carolyn McCaskey from Canada, and she always brought the issue of women in conflict and post-conflict situations. You know, the need to ensure that refugee camps have, you know, separate toilets for women and men, and the need to train peacekeeping troops about gender sensitivity even before they leave their country. She was the one raising all of these issues. But she had a gender advisor. All peacekeeping missions have gender advisor. But because the gender advisors are not at the decision-making level, it's left to a few women like Carolyn McCaskey to take up the issue of gender.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what if you don't have champions like that? I mean, and that's often the case.
And see, that's an example of moving out of rhetoric and into more action-based
program.
Yeah.
Yes.
And if you don't have a bridge between the rhetoric end of the administration and the action-based, you know, on-the-ground women that are trying to take care of problems that are right in front of them, mm-hmm. then there's a broken system. And
exactly. There's a huge disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's a huge disconnect between the words and the action.
So right now, it seems that from everything you've said, the focus is to connect that disconnect.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And have a coherence in terms of the normative functions, meaning, you know, the policy making and the operations at the ground level,
mm-hmm.
at the country level. We're tired of going to one conference to another to stress how important, you know, to address women's issues within the UN and outside the UN. Of all the four main UN agencies that have gender mainstreaming in their mandate, none of them is at the level of UN Undersecretary. And during the International Women's Day on March 8th, the Secretary General said so far there's 20% women in the system, in decision-making levels in the system. That's very far from, you know, what we are demanding. We want 50%. We want equal representation.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And, yeah, I mean, this is one of our key demands in this whole UN reform package.
For this show on women and UN reform, we'd like to thank Robin Gerber, author of the book Leadership, The Eleanor Roosevelt Way by Prentice Hall Press, Kevin McLeod for music. We'd also like to thank Frieda Weirden of Women's International News Gathering Service. For more info on this subject, you can go to Peace Women at www.peacewomen.org, Center for Women's Global Leadership at Rutgers University at www.cwgl.rutgers.edu, the Commission on the Status of Women at www.un.org/womenwatch/daw.csw, and the International Women's Tribune Center at www.iwtc.org. This has been Lee Sanzia for Wings.
Besides Eleanor Roosevelt, voices in this program were Margaret Pitcher, Denise Scotto, Charlotte Bunch, Samantha Cook, and Mavic Cabrera-Baeza. To hear them again, visit the website www.wings.org. Special thanks to Suzette Cullen and to Genevieve Vaughn, author of the new book, Homo Donans. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.